Many years ago, I was on holiday in Cornwall in Polruan-by-Foy. I was 12 years old and I was attempting to prove to my twin sister that I could walk along a 20-foot-high harbour wall with my eyes shut. So here's the harbour wall. There it is. I don't know if you can see it there. And I was on that top level trying to walk along it with my eyes shut, and sadly, I couldn't. And I fell off, and sadly, again, the tide was out, so I didn't actually land on water. And I said to my twin sister, actually, afterwards, I said, "Look, why didn't you shout?" And she said, "Well, I didn't think you really had your eyes shut." I said, "How dare you impugn my integrity? Of course my eyes were shut." So I then destroyed the family holiday, because I spent the family holiday there in the Royal Cornwall Hospital, and they spent most of the time there with me. It was dreadful. I was there for about 8 days, actually, with a bunch of bikers. We were all in the same ward. So I then was never allowed to go on a motorcycle after that either. And I learnt during that stay and afterwards what it was to use one of these, a crutch. And because this evening's sermon is Christianity a psychological crutch? Is it a crutch? I want to ask, first of all, how do you define one of these? How do you define a crutch? What is it that makes something a crutch? And I think there are three things. First of all, in terms of what a crutch is, first of all, it's artificial. So I needed a crutch because my leg wasn't working properly. Actually, my brain wasn't working properly either as I walked along that wall. But my leg was the real means of support, and it's an artificial means of support. That's what a crutch is. It's artificial. Secondly, a crutch is only needed by a few people. It's only needed by people who've got something wrong with them. So it's only a few people. You don't need a crutch unless there's something wrong with you, unless your leg isn't working properly. And thirdly, a crutch makes life easier in the short term. I needed one of those because, you know, again, you know, it did make life easier rather than trying to hop along on one leg. But one of the first things the doctor in Truro Hospital said to me, apart from "you're a stupid idiot," but one of the things he said to me was, "Look, as soon as you can get rid of this crutch, the better." So again, how do you define a crutch then? There it is. Do you see it's artificial? It's only for a few people and it makes life easier in the short term. You know, the assertion that Christianity is a psychological crutch was actually first put down by Sigmund Freud, who was a psychiatrist in Vienna, 1900 to 1930, around that period. And he actually wrote a book called The Future of an Illusion. Here it is. And in it, he said that the Christian idea of God as a father is actually an imaginary crutch. It's a projection of our need for our parents once they're gone. So we grow up, but the inner child that we've got still longs for the care and the protection and the comfort we have from our parents. And subconsciously, once our parents are gone, we project that need onto a heavenly father in the skies. He says it's understandable, but he says it's wish fulfillment. So Freud would have heard my two little boys, you know, they fall over and they cry, "Mummy, mummy, we want mummy." And Freud would have said, "Well, that goes on in life. You still want your parents as you grow old. It's understandable. But it's dependency. It's a hangover of childhood dependency." He'd have said, yeah, it's artificial. That's what it is. It's only for gullible people, this illusion in the skies. It's only for a few people who can't cope with real life. It's escapist as they sort of pray into thin air. That's what they're doing. Understandable, but an illusion. Well, I want to look at the three assertions and answer Freud a bit this evening. So first of all, is Christianity an artificial support or is it true? I mean, is it wishful thinking? Is it artificial? Or is it true? You see, if it's true, then it can't be artificial. If it's true, then it can't be imaginary. And ladies and gentlemen, the truth of the Christian faith, and thank you for coming this evening, it's a privilege to be saying this, but the truth of the Christian faith all depends on who Jesus is. And that's the question, precisely the question that is being debated. Do you see, in the passage we had read for us, in Mark chapter 8, that's the shortest biography of Jesus. And so do you see verse 27? This is the great issue. Who is Jesus? Verse 27, can we see as we look down? "Jesus and his disciples went into the villages around Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked them, Who do people say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked. Who do you say I am? And Peter answered, you are the Christ. Now look, do you know it is possible to be with someone and not know who they are? I was at a family funeral a while back, and in his tribute to his mother and her capacity to give, I think the phrase would be unsolicited feedback, her son bravely was speaking, and he was talking about a rant she was having in a restaurant in Surrey about the celebrity Chris Evans. And she then discovered halfway through this rant, literally, he was sitting at the table behind her. And she could have reached backwards and touched him. And there, it was obvious he'd heard every word she'd said. Anyway, she'd been so mortified by this, it was actually raised at her funeral. So you can imagine what she went through. But she'd been with Chris Evans. She'd been right next to him in touching distance. But she hadn't recognized him. Well, I can't bear to sort of quote Chris Evans in this context here. But actually, it's the same thing with Jesus in that way. Because the crowds are there with Mark 8. But the question is, do they recognize who Jesus was? And Jesus says to the disciples in verse 27, who do people say I am? And the crowds were mystified. I mean, they'd heard about the extraordinary circumstances of his birth. The night sky in Bethlehem lit up. And magi from the east had followed a star hundreds of miles to proclaim him king. And King Herod was so disturbed and threatened by news of his birth that he had every baby boy in Bethlehem murdered. Every boy under two murdered in the vicinity of Bethlehem, which, by the way, is documented by non-Christian sources, the murder. And the crowds had heard the way as a young boy of 12, Jesus had gone to the temple in Jerusalem, and he'd asked such questions that the teachers were staggered by his insight. They just couldn't get over the questions he was asking. And they'd seen him, actually it's earlier on in Mark chapter 2 and in other gospel accounts, they'd seen him say to a paralyzed man, get up and walk. And before their eyes, bones, muscles, tendons were knitted together without a hint of surgery. Over 30 times we read of the deaf hearing, the blind seeing, the lame walking. And the most staggering thing is that they'd actually seen him have control of nature. So in a wild storm, he'd said, quiet, be still, and the disciples were just staggered because the sea was flattened. I mean, it hadn't taken hours to go down, as happens in the storm. It was flattened. And then there was a little girl, and she had died. She's 12 years old. And her father, Jairus, a synagogue leader, had thrown himself at Jesus' feet. And he'd said, please, if you can help, come and help. And he'd gone to the home, and he'd said, little girl, I say to you, get up. And she had been raised from the dead. And the issue is, you see, with these miracles that, can I say, again, if you're someone inquiring this evening, the Samaritan historian, a non-Christian, a man called Josephus, he calls Jesus a doer of wonderful deeds. Everyone was talking about this power this man had. They just didn't know where it came from. Some people said, well, it's from the devil. Others said, well, I'll report it. We don't know where it's from. There's some miraculous power. But something was going on. Who is he? This man who can cure leprosy, and from whose lips the finest sermon ever heard was preached, the Sermon on the Mount, in which, by the way, in the modern world, he calls us to love our enemies. And then he does that as he dies on the cross. He says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do of the people murdering him. I mean, who is this man? And so the crowds know that he's not an ordinary man. That's what's going on. And as they look at him, they've got this evidence. And so what the crowds do is, well, can we see in the passage here? They try and work out who he is by going back in history. They say, well, he must be Elijah, or John the Baptist was extraordinary. This prophet, he's one of the prophets. So they try and fit Jesus into their history. But I want you to hold on to your seats here, because actually, as Jesus says to Peter, what do you say about me? What do you think my identity is? actually what happens here is it begins to emerge that if he's the Christ, if he's God's coming king, actually he's the Lord over history. So who do you say I am? What's his identity? Well, it begins to get very, very big indeed, because if he can flatten a storm and if he can raise a dead girl, then suddenly he gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so do you see in verse 27, there's a general information question. Who do people say I am? But then in verse 29, as he turns to the crowd, as he turns to the disciples, what about you? Who do you say I am? Well, it gets personal. And that's what's happening here. It now gets very personal in verse 29, because the question is, well, what about you personally? Who do you say he is? I mean, it's rather like, you know, who did you vote for in May 2015, if you're able to vote in this country? You know, that's not a general one. That's not who did people vote for, Labour, Conservative, SNP, whatever it is, Liberal Democrats. That's personal. Who did you vote for? And it's not actually who did your parents vote for, or your brother or your sister or your colleagues or your spouse. It's you. It tells me something about you. And that's what gets pushed here. Who do you say he is? And Peter says, you're the Christ. Now, can I say this word Christ as we look down here? That's not just under C in the Nazareth phone book. No, no, it means the anointed king. So Peter was saying Jesus was the king of the Old Testament, who was promised in the Old Testament, who would demonstrate his power and authority. So he doesn't, as I say, fit into history. He's the Lord of history. And we see that, can we see, if we look on in the passage, this lordship of history, because Mark 9, the next passage coming up, verses 2, 3, and 7, gets, well, utterly supernatural. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him, led him up into a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white. So he is the head of history now. The one towards whom all history will go, the one who will be the judge of history. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to me." So the creator of the world has intervened in the world. He sent his son, and he's now speaking over his son. Yes, we don't believe in a closed universe. It's an open universe in which the creator can say, "I am going to speak to you about my son." And can I say, just in terms of who this is at this point in time, what this is saying is, and you know, it's very confronting, is it's saying, if I refuse to listen to Jesus, I refuse to listen to God. And if I reject Jesus, I reject his Father, the God who made me. There are huge issues here. And why does it matter? Well, have a look back, chapter 8, and can you see verse 38, that last verse? Jesus says, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. In other words, I am coming back to judge this world. So he comes as a child, a baby in a manger. We know that story. He comes, he's a carpenter. He comes and he ends up crucified on a cross. But he then rises from the dead and he'll come back in blazing white as the Lord of history. It's extraordinary. He says, I will return. Now, can I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, do you believe this? What do you think about it? And can I say, as we come to this, phrase, you're the Christ, says Peter, if that's true, then Christianity can't be artificial. And we're saying, now this is so important, it's based on evidence. It's got historical clothing. It's not, as Freud says, wishful thinking. We're saying, no, 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 actually, there's a mountain of evidence to look at. Yes, we're saying God has intervened in the world he's made, but he's given us such evidence that he's done that. So, you know, the creed, perhaps you know the Christian creed. Maybe you said it as a child, now and again, maybe at school, I don't know. Crucified under Pontius Pilate. Well, that can be investigated. Did it happen? And then on the third day, he rose again. That can be investigated. There's a mountain of evidence. And can I say again, if these things about the life, death of resurrection and resurrection of Jesus are true, then it can't be artificial. And that's why we're saying this course, Life Explored, starting on Monday, would be wonderful to have you at. It would be a joy to have you there. Just come and ask any question you like, but we'll look at the evidence. That's one of the things we'll do. I can't really finish on evidence without saying something about from C.S. Lewis. Here it is. He says, either this is of total importance or of no importance whatsoever. The one thing it can never be is of moderate importance. If he's the head of the universe, can't be of moderate importance. Can't be something where I say, well, actually, I'm not going to bother voting. I'll just go along. No, he gives me each breath if this is true. So if it's true, if he really is the Christ, it can't be artificial. What do you think? On we go. Look, the second thing that defines a crutch is it's only for a few people who can't cope, who need it because their leg isn't working. Well, is that true of the Christian faith? You see, in other words, is it not needed by ordinary, normal, healthy people? Well, have a look down at verse 31 as we look at this second issue. Can we see verse 31? He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Now, can I say the Greek word must here means necessary for certain great ends. So the word must is crucial to understand it. Jesus says, I, the Son of Man, must suffer. I must be rejected. I must be killed. I must rise. So he's adamant that these things had to happen. So Jesus is saying he had to die, he had to be rejected, he had to rise again because we needed him to do that. In other words, every single man, woman, child in the world needs what he's going to do on that Easter Friday and Sunday. Now, the issue here as we look at this is, I mean, I suppose this is the issue, is that are these universal needs or do they only apply to a few weak people? Jesus says, I've got to do it. Well, is that just for a few weak people or is this a universal need? I mean, the fact that we have a need and there's something that can satisfy that need does not make that something a crutch. Let me give you an example. For example, we need food. Is food therefore a crutch? Well, you might say, well, we can do without food. Well, we can for, I guess, a couple of months. But then I think you begin to get quite hungry. We all need food. Well, what about water? Is water a crutch? You can survive for, what, 3 or 4 days without water, maybe a week. Or air, maybe 10 minutes. We need air. Is it therefore a crutch because we need it? Well, you may say, well, look, Rico, those things are physical things, which if you don't have, you die physically. Christianity, if you don't have that, you don't die physically. Well, okay, well, let's take it to another layer. What about the emotional level? I mean, for example, love. Is love a crutch? I mean, we all need love, and if we don't have it, then we become emotionally crippled. I'll never forget one of our mission partners is Rachel Cook. There she is. And she was a nurse in an Eastern Bloc country 20 years ago. And I'll never forget her coming back from this work that she was doing. And she was working among babies that were orphaned in the middle of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. So their parents had died of AIDS, and there were these babies in these wards. And she walked into a ward of 50 babies, and there was total silence. Total silence, 50 babies in the room. And she said later, well, of course, the children had stopped crying because they knew whether they cried or didn't cry, no one would come because no one cared. So, no point crying, no one's going to come. No one loved them, no one cared. Emotionally, we need love or we become emotionally dysfunctional human beings. So what is it about Christ that we all need as we need food, water, air, and love? Well, Christ meets our spiritual needs. Now, can you see verse 31? Here we are. Do you see it? He must be killed. It's necessary that he be killed. That's what we learn. He's got to be killed so that I can be forgiven. I mean, what do we do about guilt? I mean, not the things that we shouldn't feel guilty about. We can deal with those. But the things we should feel guilty about. And can I say, we actually get great insight about how serious the things we should feel guilty about are, because we see the scale of the penalty when we look at the cross. So when I ask you this question, do you know why Jesus had to die on the cross? Because Christians see the enormity of Christ's death for them in their place, they see the fact that actually guilt is a tremendously important thing, because it points us to what we've done wrong in God's world with hands and feet and eyes and attitude, and that will actually mean that there will be a culpability. Jesus had to die because the cross tells us that wrongdoing is serious. And when we feel guilt, it is pointing to something. That's why Jesus had to die on a cross. He died because in the face of our guilt, we don't need a crutch, we need a rescuer. And again, have a look down at verse 38. This is why it's important. Because Jesus says at the end of time, he'll come in his Father's glory with the holy angels. So he says, I'm rising from the dead. And that's the proof that you'll be raised from the dead. And that's the proof that the world to come has broken into this world. And that means that there will be a final day of reckoning, which is a great thing. Because it means how I treat you matters to God, how you treat me matters to God, how we treat the world matters to God. But guilt is pointing me to something very serious. The cross is pointing me to something very serious. And verse 38 says, this is how serious. He's going to return and he's going to judge this world. So either I come to Jesus now as my savior, as a substitute on the cross. So it's not just a Galilean carpenter dying. He dies there in my place for my wrongdoing, paying in death and blood for what I've done wrong. Or the Bible says, I will face him as my judge when I'm raised on the day of judgment, and the resurrection's the proof of it. Now, can I say, at one level, the Bible does say that in this life now, many who are flooded with God's gifts can go through life ignoring the giver. So there's a Psalm 73, that speaks of actually people who ignore God, and it says their bodies are healthy and strong, they have no struggles. They're free of the burdens common to man. They're always carefree. They increase in wealth. They claim with their mouths, they lay claim to heaven. It speaks of flourishing without God as we take the gifts of God and ignore the giver. But that day comes to an end. There'll be a day when we're raised and God will say, well, did you know me? And did you get your sin forgiven? And please don't tell me it wasn't important. Otherwise, why did I send my son to die? I sent my son to die because this is crucially important. Now, the Brits then respond, well, I lived a decent life. Well, if living a decent life was enough, why did he send his son to die? No, our conscience is often subjective, but can I say, ladies and gentlemen, it's incredibly useful. It points to this judgment day. And God raised Jesus to prove that it will come and that we desperately need forgiveness. But can I say, it is a joy to be forgiven. It's such a wonderful thing to have your identity there. This is the diver, Greg Louganis. He won a gold medal. You may have remembered one of his dives. Midway through the competition, he misfired on a dive and he sort of smashed his head, and yet he still went on to win a gold medal. But he was asked, Louganis, they said, look, how do you perform so well under pressure? And he said, I stand on the board and I remind myself that my mother loves me and I dive. In other words, he reminds himself of the one relationship that is unconditional regardless of performance. And can I say, ladies and gentlemen, if Jesus says, I must suffer, I must be killed, I must be raised, he's saying that so that you can find your identity in him. So that you can find an unconditional relationship where he says, I know all about you. That's why I came to die. And I'm for you. I'm profoundly for you. And I want you to find your identity in this relationship where I know all about you. So I've died for your wrongdoing. I'm sending my spirit to change you. And one day I will see you face to face. Oh, the joy of it. Do you know, one of the ministry team said as we were preparing for, as I was preparing for this sermon, she said in the staff meeting on Thursday, she said when she was at college, she'd been at Cambridge, she said there was such a jibe about Christianity being a crutch for the weak, the Christians needing that, that she said we actually developed a little response. She said this was a response: Christianity isn't just a crutch for the weak, but it's life for the dead. So it's not just that I get forgiven on Good Friday. By Christ rising on Easter Day, when he says, I'll rise, he says it's life for the dead. Oh, what a joy that is. And it's a universal need. It's not just for weak people. We all need it. Well, I must draw to a close, but let me finish with our third heading. Does Christianity make life easier? So it is a form of escapism. That's the question. I mean, you know, is it that? Well, let's have a look down, and can I ask you what you make of verse 34? Does it look like escapism? Does it look as though it makes life easier, just as a crutch makes life easier because a leg isn't working, so you've got it? Does this look as though it makes life easier? Have a look down, verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples. He said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. Now, please see here that the word, it's the word must again. So in verse 31, Jesus said that he must suffer, he must die. And in verse 34, he tells me that if I want to go the way of Christ, I must be prepared to suffer and to die. And please see the three phrases here. Do you see what he says? He says, you must deny yourself. So denying yourself means saying no. Jesus says you must say no to self-rule, no to self-gratification, no to selfishness. He says actually at the heart of this is I've lived for others to serve them, and you must do the same. You must live to serve others. Can I say, oh, as Christians, I'm sorry when we haven't done that. If you're here tonight and you've been badly treated, but it's not the way of the master. If people have treated you like that and they call themselves Christian, they need forgiveness from God and from you. But his way is no to self-rule, no to self-gratification, no to selfishness. He also says, do you see here, you must take up your cross. Now, the cross represented a criminal's death. It was full of shame and humiliation. It's what the Romans did to their enemies. They say, look what we'll do to you if you rebel against us. That was the cross. This is what we'll do. We'll string you up naked and you'll die in agony. And so the society was saying, ultimately with a cross to the criminal, we don't want you. You're no longer fit to live among us. We're going to kill you as an example. You must die. And Jesus says, if you follow me, then please understand there's rejection. And it could mean death. Well, again, does that make life easier? And then again, do you see what he says? He says, you must follow me here. Well, the disciples were physically going to follow Jesus to Jerusalem, but metaphorically, Jesus was saying, my way is now to be your way. And we, by the way, we live in an age that is defined in some ways by materialism and individualism. So materialism says, my comfort comes first. And individualism says, my choices come first. And yet Jesus says, deny yourself, take up your cross, follow me. Now, does that sound as though it makes life easier in the short term? Actually, the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, often, very often, people reject the Christian faith because they know it will be hard. So they know it's true, but they reject it because they say, no, this will be too hard. And actually, often what stops people becoming Christians, can I say, when they know it's true. So they believe Jesus died on Good Friday. They believe he rose on Easter Day. They believe he's Lord and God, and yet he is absolutely in the suburbs because, actually, there's pleasure, power, or popularity that they want. They know it's true, but they don't want to stand with Jesus, and can I assure you of this at times, in a world that stands against him. I was at a rugby dinner last Friday, and I met a guy there who, 25 years ago I spoke to, I'm convinced he still believes Jesus is God, and yet he's been at arm's length for, well, all that guy's life. And it's these things. pleasure, power, popularity. Now look, if those things are stopping you actually confronting and living with the truth of who Christ is, are they not a crutch? If you're leaning on those things and not going the way of truth. So it was Aldous Huxley, who was a famous unbeliever, and at the end of his life, he said these words: "For myself, the philosophy of meaningless was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political." In other words, he says, it suited me very well to believe what I believed. It suited me. Really, it was because I had things that I wanted to do, and I wanted liberation, total liberation, to decide on my choices, to ignore the one who was at the head of the universe. So he's saying in some ways his belief was a crutch. He wasn't facing the truth. And Jesus' teaching here is very uncomfortable. It means, can I say this, saying no to self daily. And that is not escapism. And by the way, at this point in time, I've got to say it's just such a privilege in a way to be able to preach here and to be a Christian in the West. Because if you read, for example, this, the new Eusebius, which is what happened to Christians in the first, until AD 337. So, the first 300 years of the Christian church. Well, you'd never say it makes life easier. I mean, you look at this book, it's just absolutely staggering. So there's a young boy of 15 called Pontius. And Caesar says, torture him until he dies or until he denies Christ. And this 15-year-old boy dies. Now, you said to them, well, it makes life easier. I mean, they'd have said, what do you mean? I mean, we're off to the lions. I mean, if it's a crutch at that moment, throw it away if it's just a crutch. Deny yourself, take up your cross, follow me. I mean, those words, ladies and gentlemen, they don't amount to escapism. And the reason we say them to you, by the way, is that we hate it when people withhold information. I can't bear it when people do that to me. So I hope you see here that as we've looked at this, if you're investigating Christian faith, we have not withheld information. But as we do that, we want to say this. Well, have a look, if you would, down at verse 35. Look at that. Because amidst that, amidst the fact it's not escapism, amidst the fact it's saying no to self, actually Jesus says, whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. It's so counterintuitive. But Jesus, it's as though he says, look, I'll tell you what, as you lean into me, as you lean on me, as you give your life away for me in the gospel, do you know it's the most extraordinary thing? What you're doing, you see, is you're aligning yourself with the universe, with how the world works. And as you do that, you'll find yourself. You'll find a profound joy. I mean, human happiness is external. You've got to get all the externals right. Christian joy is internal, and it comes from knowing and following Jesus Christ in the hardest of circumstances, which is why the early Christians, do you know, at one point in one manuscript, they were asked to stop singing as they were being thrown to the lions because it was putting the lions off. And there was this joy. They were staggering as they outlived everyone. If there was a foundling baby that was left on a slope to die, the Christians gathered it up and took him into their home. Took her into their home. Gave their lives to serve. And they were people of joy. Could this be true, you see, as you give your life away, you find it. If you try and save it, you'll lose it. So counterintuitive. But what do you make of those words? And as you look at Jesus, and as he throws out a promise like that, will you take him at his word? Oh, well, I must conclude, but it's been a joy to speak to you. But here are the three things we're saying. Well, Christianity is not a crutch because it's not artificial, it's true. Why not come in 8 days' time and chat about that and talk? Or talk with the person you've come with this evening. And Christianity is not a crutch because it's not needed by a few people. We all need the death and resurrection of Jesus. We need forgiveness. We need hope in the face of death. Desperately, I do. It's a universal need that he brings, that spiritual need. And thirdly, Christianity is not a crutch because it's not the easy way out. It's tough. But it's a great joy. It's an extraordinary joy. It's a joy that's at the heart of the universe, to know Jesus Christ, who has made us and has died for us and has risen again. And above all, the symbol of Christianity is not a crutch, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a crutch. Can I say, it's a cross. And Jesus says to every single person here tonight, he says, who do you say that I am? And if you say the Christ, then he says, follow me. Let me pray. Oh, Father God, I pray for each person here this evening as we battle to make time amidst all the pressures of life to wrestle through the identity of Jesus. Oh, please, Father, give us the mind time to cast this vote ourselves, to not let anyone else do it for us, to look ourselves. And Father, as we do that, we pray that we would find life in all its wonder. Amen.